came home a year ago last summer, and we are now going to retire in Bonners Ferry, Idaho, as of this summer. I've noticed a statement, I've even heard it here, that I've been hearing ever since I left Tanzania, I guess, as we traveled through Europe and then we hit America, and I'm hearing people say, it's a small world, isn't it? Or the world's getting smaller. You can probably think that you've said this maybe even since you came here, as you've met someone and you found some connection, say, well, isn't it a small world? And this came home to me very much one day when I was cleaning out my household back in Tanzania. I ran across a little booklet about Africa, a little bit about the history of the old Augustana mission to Tanganyika. And when I read about our first missionary, Pastor Ralph Hult, that went out to Africa to look for a field, went to West Africa, and then he was called to go to East Africa to take over the Leipzig mission orphaned fields after the war. And when I read about his getting from West Africa to East Africa, I was really amazed. He and his wife had to travel, I think, 1,000 miles or more by foot, horseback, hammock, river barge, to get to the west coast, to get a ship, to go way around the Cape up to East Africa. And they started on this trip sometime early in, this was in 1921, in the fall when he got the call. And he didn't reach East Africa until December 19th, 1922. I know they did stop for 3.5 weeks someplace in West Africa while she had her first child. But I just thought about getting from just West Africa to East Africa, it took that long. In 1952, when we traveled out to Tanganyika, we went by train, and then by ship, and then by train up country, and it took us 6 weeks. And then I thought about when we come home now, we leave Nairobi or Kilimanjaro Airport in Tanzania, maybe a little after midnight. And we were on the west coast in our home in Idaho that night. And I thought, the world is getting smaller, isn't it? So I thought a lot about that. But then as I've come home and I've been talking with people then, we started to wonder, but is it getting smaller in our own thinking? Do we really know what's happening on the other side of the world? And are we getting smaller and coming closer together, or are we coming farther apart? And I think that's kind of part of what we feel is the message that we like to share, is what do we have to learn as Christians about fellow Christians in the rest of the world, and what do they have to contribute that we can gain and learn something that will be helpful for us. Before we go into some of these topics, I noticed that some of you were looking at the cloth. These beautiful cloths are very much a symbol, I would like to say, of the women of Africa. They have been wearing these cloths from, I think, in the middle of the 1800s. They started first using these cloths, and now they have become a very much tourists like them very much too. And every woman, it's just something she likes to possess, many of these beautiful colored cloths, and I think they portray something of the friendly and some of the feeling of the people. Now they make them for special occasions. Many times they'll print one, and that particular one there was printed when the athletes came from all over Africa to Nairobi for the All Africa Games three years ago. It says on there, Karibu Wageni, that means welcome guests. They always have a saying on them. Sometimes it's a proverb or an African proverb or some saying. But then when I left, they thought that it was very appropriate, I think, to give me some of these cloths as a woman, because what more proper gift would an African woman like? And they thought that I would like, and I certainly do appreciate them. So they gave me some of these cloths, and they do wear them.
Don't throw the old one away. And when they gave it to her, they said, when you get new friends in America, don't throw the old ones in Africa away. We've worked, by the way, today I think we're going to have a little more relaxed hour. Yesterday we felt kind of guilty afterwards. We tried to put too much into 1 hour and didn't have enough give and take. So we've approached the hour today with Oh, excuse me. So we approach this hour with a little more nonchalance, huh? And we want to mention a few things and then hope we can get some conversation going. We've worked for the Division of Global Missions of the, or it was called the Division of World Missions and Ecumenism of the old LCA for all these years. And it's always been foremost in our thoughts regarding the mission of the church, three aspects of it in our thinking. Now, we want to this morning share a little bit more about you about the ecumenical aspect of it. Because when the gospel is presented to people, and when it's accompanied by works of mercy and development and justice, so that it isn't just words, you'll always find that there are some people that believe. And when they believe, they establish congregations, worship centers. And they become, to the people around them, in some way or another, part of the service and teaching role of the church. Well, when this happens, these people are blessed. They are enriched. The enrichment means that they are also purged. There's always something in our society that needs to be dealt with. But much of the good is brought to the fore. And so they would be the first to say that in this experience of becoming part of the body of Christ around the world, we are enriched. Even the best traditions that we have of our own become more important to us. But it's also true, and that's the ecumenical part, that whenever this happens, it is intention of God, we believe, that the whole body of Christ around the world be enriched. And that's what a few years back, you know, we were all talking very loudly about mission two-way, or mission six continents or something. Now, you can put it any way you want to. But you never do missions just with the intent of giving. You always receive as well as you give. And so this is our theme for today. Christianity, according to John Mbiti, an East African theologian, living in Switzerland now, by the way, but an African, he says that Christianity is always a beggar seeking food, drink, cover, and shelter from the cultures and times it encounters on its never-ending journeys and wanderings throughout the world. This is true. And the church takes on the color of the culture of the people, much as a river takes on the color of the soil through which it flows. Near where we lived at Makumira for many years is a river that the Africans call Maji Achai, the river of tea, because it flows through an area where the water takes on the color of tea. And you'll have rivers of all sorts of colors, gray ones and all kinds, depending on whether it's coming through volcanic ash or African red soil or whatever it is. Well, the church is that way. It's affected. It's supposed to be affected by the culture. It's supposed to become incarnate to a certain extent, at least among the people through which it passes. So for this short time today, we just want to suggest a few themes around which we might explore this enrichment that God wants to give us through this part of the church in Africa, the church in Tanzania, the part that we know the best. And we do this for two reasons. First, because, as I've already said, we believe it's right. It's the way it's supposed to be. We're supposed to learn from them. They're supposed to contribute. Secondly, we do it because we want to counteract a bit the media in America, which it seems to us is heavily laden on showing just the misery and suffering of Africa. If you watch TV, you get the idea that almost every African is either dying of starvation or displaced by war. Now, there is enough of this there, but we want to let you know that there are millions of Africans that aren't living that way, and that in their life they do have something to contribute to our welfare and our well-being and our contentment and peace in the world in which we live as well. Now, the next theme is yours.
Well, one of the first contributions that we would like to think of a little bit about is happiness and its relation to possessions. And we think here that the African Christians have something to share with us. One of the characteristics of the Africans, I think, which we really learned as we lived amongst them, is their ability to enjoy life with a minimum of possessions. I mean, sometimes there was no choice. But still, we always could experience that they could show happiness, even if they didn't have a lot. So maybe that is one of the gifts that they can share with us, that happiness, enjoyment, contentment do not depend on amassing things. There's a verse from Proverbs 38 that seems very fitting. Give me neither poverty nor wealth. Provide me only with the food I need. If I have too much, I shall deny thee and say, who is the Lord? If I'm reduced to poverty, I shall steal and blacken the name of God. It seems to us, though, that either end of the economic spectrum tends to dehumanize. For example, if you draw a half circle, and on the one end, to be very, very poor, so poor that you don't even know what you're going to eat tomorrow, that you have to scratch around like a chicken or just go begging for food, that is very dehumanizing. But we also see on the other end of the spectrum those who have so much that they really don't appreciate it or know what to do with it all is also dehumanizing. But somewhere in between, there is a happy medium, and there is the place where we can find happiness in sharing. I think one of the things, we've always lived in a rural area in Tanzania, we've just always been amazed how I always, when I would go into very simple houses, very little, but how they're at any hour, any time, they were always sharing of whatever they have. Maybe it was just a cup of black tea. Really, I think their food of hospitality is a cup of chai, and that is, you know, tea with half milk, half water, and lots of sugar, and that's what they really feel is hospitality. Like, I think in America, the Swedes, it's a cup of coffee or something, but it is chai. But there have been many times that tea, sugar's not available, milk's not available, but they don't apologize. They say they'll just put on their black cup of tea and you'll sit around and you'll enjoy it. Whatever they have, they will share. And another example that I was thinking about is the African children. I've come back here and I've seen children with so many toys and yards cluttered with things and go into rooms and you stumble over everything. And then children come back and they say, Mom, I'm bored, I don't know what to do. And this just floors me. I mean, I just can't. And I've seen the African children just out playing with nothing, and they're making their own little cars out of sticks and little pieces of wire and playing their games and the happiness that they show with so few things. And I remember once when an African bishop, or not an African bishop, a bishop from America came, and his wife, and they came to Old Anyasambo to visit us. And the children of one of our staff members there that worked at the conference center were always around playing. And the little girl, she had on her just little everyday. She didn't have a lot of nice clothes, but she had on her little everyday dress. It was getting a little short and was a little tattered and dirty, and she was barefoot and playing with her brothers. And they were so shocked when they saw her, and they said, but she doesn't have any shoes to wear. And we had never really thought about that, because we said, but, you know, she's really a happy little girl, and she has security. She's got love. She goes home. There's always food. Her mother always provides. There's food on the table for her, and she is really a happy little girl because she is secure and she's loved. And she does have a nice dress that she wears to church on Sunday and some shoes, but she always keeps those for special. And that made me think, too, where our values are as we look at the children.
Maybe some of this ability of the Africans to live contented and happy lives without a lot of possessions, maybe some of that has rubbed off on our children a little bit, I'm not sure. But I remember one day when David and I, our oldest son, when he was working out that, we were walking down the streets of Arusha, and I had just heard about a man happened to be a Canadian who was working with a wheat scheme, and I heard that he was the head of their party, and he made $300 a day, and that seemed like a lot of money to me. And I saw him across the street, and I said to David, you know, that man makes $300 a day. And quick as a wink, David said, yes, but he can't eat any more than I can. The next theme that we want to explore is life in community. It seems to me that this is a strength that we could do well to imbibe of. Huh? Africans say in Swahili, mtu ni watu, which means a person is people. Or they say, nipo kwa sababu tupo, I am here because we are here. Those are the kind of things they'd be writing on some of these cloths. Huh? And that shows you that individualism that's so dear to us is not allowed to run rampant in the same way among them. It's also true, I think, that we should be aware of the fact that our history of the past did not allow for the extreme individualism that has become a part of our life, perhaps. Well, I like to trace it back to the French Revolution and the Enlightenment in brackets and all these things, but there are a lot of ways where you could talk about this. But anyway, we are a fairly individualistic society. We've taught at Gustavus off and on, and among these young people, the thing, you know, they always like to say is, I want to do my own thing. Huh? Well, this isn't something you hear very much in Africa, because you can't do your own thing. You're part of a family. You're part of a clan. You're part of this. It's true that there is a way where you can do some of the things you believe you're talented for and that, but yet always within the picture of the family and the picture of the community. We came to a place when we came home about a year ago where our daughter was showing us a beautiful home on the side of a mountain, and it was a beautiful home, and we looked at it, and I said, where are the people? And she said, well, a woman and her two children live here. And I said, where's the man? And she said, well, he's out on a two-year search for an authentic experience of God. Huh? And I thought, well, what? How sick can we become if you think you have to leave home and family to find God? Huh? And Africans would be the first to say that our life in community is extremely important for our own welfare and being. It's true that when they emphasize this to the extreme, it makes it difficult when, for example, as we mentioned last night and yesterday, when one member of a clan is convinced of the truth of the Christian faith and wants to become a Christian. Then he has real problems with the oneness of this clan for a while. But even so, usually you'll find that after a while there's sort of some sort of a reconciliation, and the strength of the family is still significant for them. We think that this should mean something to us as we live with the African people. For example, or as we interact with them in our life as one body of Christ. For example, it may mean something to us even in how we value our thinking of those who have died from our families and the fellowship of our faith. Africans haven't been too quick to do this yet because they're very close to this. They've always lived in a society in which there's supposed to be some sort of fellowship going on between them and members of the living dead, members of their family that have died and are still remembered on earth. There should be some visions or dreams or something where they become real to them, and that often happens. What we think this means is that in the Christian church, they're going to make a lot more of All Saints Day than we have. That this is somehow going to come to the fore and be a very strong part of their life. And I know it's becoming to be more a part of our life now. Even the much understood church discipline that you hear about in Africa, where they actually excommunicate people and put people on discipline for certain things now, that's misunderstood usually because it's not thought of in terms of this communal life of the people of Christ. Because what they are doing in community is forming a synthesis between the old and the new as far as morality is concerned. And they are doing this together, not individually. Take, for example, the woman that comes to the congregation, as has often happened with us, and she says, I married my husband. We were both Christians. We married as a monogamous marriage. And now, without my permission, consent, he's added another wife. Huh? And she comes to the elders and wants to talk to us about this. My point isn't to get in a lengthy argument about what we're going to tell her to do or anything or advise her about, but my point is she doesn't want to make this decision by herself. As a Christian, what do we do about this? And we talk about it together, 20, 30 elders and her together. And we call the husband in and we talk to him. And the whole thing is talked about together. And in the end, there is some consensus of what we think this couple should do. Because we just don't want every person to individually beginning to formulate this new synthesis between the old and the new. But we want to do it together in the way we look at our life together in the body of Christ. Maybe we can have some give and take on this a little later. Now I want to mention another theme that we thought was worthy of Africa's contribution to world Christianity, and that is their worldview, or their philosophy of life, if you want to put it that way, or how they look at the whole world. And the main thing, it seems to me, and this affects their Christianity very much, but it's a part of their African tradition pre-Christian, and that is that the world is created in such a way that there's a spiritual dimension to everything that you see. There is nothing which is merely physical, but the physical always manifests the spiritual. There isn't only that which you see, but that which you see also puts you in touch with that which you don't see. Whenever you live in the visible world, the tangible world, you are exposed to the spiritual dimension of the whole universe. John Mbiti says this very well in his book, African Religion and Philosophy, in various ways. But this means that they are, from the beginning, a holistic people. Huh? They don't tend to compartmentalize things so that you have the spiritual here and the physical here, the private here and the public here, the political on the one hand and the personal on the other. This isn't the way they look at life. And we have been kind of experts at polarizing things. This hasn't been our tradition way of the past, but it has been of the last couple hundred years. And maybe we can be helped by them to correct this. They can be helped by us, too, in certain ways. But surely here is a place where we can look at life. What it means is that they believe that they know in many more ways than we normally think we know. We know through the senses. We know through reason. And they do too, but they say the whole gamut of human experience is not included or is not limited to reason. There are lots of things that are beyond logic that are part of our life, they say. We've never met Africans who say that they aren't interested in learning and in reason. But never would they say, that's it. When we use our head, we know everything. Huh? They would say there is intuition, and there are dreams and visions and all of these different ways whereby we know things. The first time this came very strong to me was way back in 1953 when I was still struggling with Swahili and had moved to the place where we were working. And my co-pastor, an African, Pastor Simeon Petro, came to me one day very burdened because the doctor had just told him that his wife should have a tubal ligation, should have an operation because she'd had so many children, and if she had any more, she probably wouldn't live. And that was a tremendous thing for him to decide, you see. And all I could do, that was a tremendous thing for him to decide because probably you remember what I said in another hour for them, the more children you have, the more security you have at old age. But not only that, the more security you have in life after death. Because your children sacrificing at your grave is what gives you a good welfare in the world beyond death. And this sort of thing. But anyway, I couldn't even understand everything about this because my Swahili was kind of poor. But I tried to say a few things for him and tell him to go home and sleep on it and come back and we'd talk in the morning. And he came back in the morning and I could tell right away that he wasn't really bothered about this anymore. And then he told me a long, elaborate dream. And my Swahili wasn't up to getting all parts of the dream. But through the dream, he said, I've got the message. I know now what I'm supposed to do. And he knew. And there was no question about that this dream was sent to him from God. And these type of experiences are quite common to the people, the way they are guided. In fact, I could stand here and tell you a long time about some of the dreams I have. I've been in Africa so long I don't fit in America anymore. This is, we sit in a class like this and start talking, for example, about guidance, about strength, about spiritual renewal. And Aeneas sits back there and he says, well, I have a dream that recurs again and again. And it's a wonderful dream. I want to tell it to you. And then you tell me what more about what it means. And then he told us the dream where he lived in his little house with a wooden shutter. And he says, the shutter in his dream was open. And in this dream, when he was sleeping, a butterfly as big as the window came in. And it came and hovered over his head on the bed and fluttered its wings. And he said, it filled me with peace and power and love in a marvelous way. And then it left again. And then I woke up and he said, and I had this peace and power for days afterward. And then after a while, I'd have the dream again, he said. And all I said to him was that I'm no expert on interpreting dreams, but I do know that in Christian tradition and symbolism, the butterfly is a symbol of the resurrection. And that's all he had to know. That made his day for the next couple weeks. This is the way life is for them. Many things come to them through other ways than the rational. Not that the rational is divorced from it, but this is part of their life. One night I had a dream that our Toyota car was coming down the gravel road of our driveway right for me, and instead of the license plate in front, which is usually black and yellow, there was a big plate, black and white, and on it said expiration date. And I woke up, and right away I realized I'd been driving without a road license and insurance for 3 weeks. And so I wrote it down and said, go to town and get your insurance renewed. So the dividing of life, the compartmentalizing of life, which is kind of common to us, is not part of their tradition, and it's not part of what they will bring to us in the church. They will look at everything in a whole way. In fact, sometimes the biggest problem a missionary has is we'll say to when he's talking to his African friends and the Christians, he'll say that, you're looking at both of these things, you're accepting both of them. You can't do that. You got to skip one or the other. You can't walk both those roads. But they'll say, yes, we can. We have, we are, and we will. And this is one of the things you learn, that life is all thought of together, and it isn't very easy to compartmentalize it in any way. In fact, this spiritual force that pervades the universe is a basis for health, because it breaks through nature, it breaks through people, it establishes relationship, which speak of health. It goes back to person and community then, of course, because the first question an African asks when he's sick, if he's a traditional African, is whom have I argued with? Because the sickness has come from this broken relationship, and it has to be healed. Now, obviously, this is a very good, wonderful thing if also they can learn about the germ theory so that they have both ways to heal people. That's what's happening today. Now, the final theme that I want to suggest to you is simply the Africans' way they look at faith and reason, or the reason in their life. The way I think this, you know, they all these tie together. What we just said ties into it. The way I think this has hit me is when it comes to teaching theology. I've never. Well, one thing, the thought forms and the background of the Bible are more like theirs than ours. The book of Acts is not throwing curves at them all the time like it is at us. Where you have, if you take out of the book of Acts dreams and visions and unusual happenings, you're left with some pretty empty pages. And we sort of, I don't know what we do with that. It's strange to us. It isn't strange to them. It sort of fits. But the other thing is when I teach theology, I can't really get them interested in the introductory questions of the Old Testament, for example. Who wrote it, when, and the theories about that this part was the J document, this was the EEDP document, and all this sort of that. The most I've ever decided that I have to get across to them is that the Old Testament was written over a long period of time by many different people. And thus you had, and this is no problem to them, because they say, well, we trust something that comes through many people rather than one author. Huh? If a lot of uncles and aunts tell it to you, it's more likely to be true than if one man writes it. If he's wrong in the head, you really got it wrong. But if 10 or 12 of them come at it, you got a composite picture. Huh? So oral tradition doesn't bother them at all. Huh? They say, this is what we've had all along, you know. And this type of thing. It's easy for them. Is this thing up so you get me, or isn't it? The other part of their life in the church that I think is significant for us is how they look at sacraments. Sacraments are not difficult for them to conceive of in any way, because their whole life has been ritualized. All of the rites of passage from birth to puberty to marriage to parenthood to old age and to death have all been ritualized. There have been words accompanied with actions in all these cases. So when you come to think of the sacrament, for example, that words are acted out, that they are living signs accompanied by blessings, by power. This is normal to them. And then they at least some of them sometimes do it in their way. I remember we had been studying in our self-instructional material in the extension course about the Lord's Supper, Holy Communion, the Eucharist, whatever you call it, in the history of the church. We talked about sacrifice in the Old Testament, sacrifice in the New Testament, sacrifice as it relates to the Eucharist, and then the different views, the real presence, the sacrificial, like the Roman Catholic, and the in memory, like the Baptists, and so forth. We reviewed all those, and then we said, all this is in Swahili, of course, but we said, now on this other side of this piece of paper, write down what you think the Lord's Supper means to you as an African. And this student was a Catholic catechist, Olasiki, from way out in northern Tanzania. And I remember he said, well, Jesus knew that in order to have a wholeness in life after death, you have to be remembered by people on earth. You see how he was thinking as an African. Huh? But Jesus knew also that he would never have a family, because he was called to be the Messiah and to die for the sins of the world. So instead, he called those who believed in him together, and they were his family, and he said, now when you do this, drink this wine and eat this bread, remember me. Like we remember our ancestors who have died before. Remember me. But there is a difference, he said, because Jesus is not a living dead. He's not the ordinary living dead. He was a living dead for 2 days, and then he was raised from the dead, and he's alive. And so he, every time we remember him, he comes back to have fellowship with us, and the memory of our first brother who conquered death and the people who are left on earth is kept alive by this service always. Huh? Now, it may not be the last word on the Lord's Supper, but as someone who teaches theology to Africans, I was thrilled that he was thinking in an African way when he thought of the Lord's Supper. Huh? I think these are some of the things that we should remember can enrich our life when we think of our life together with them in the family of Christ.